She turned and smiled at him impishly. "Don't I look old enough? I got my doctorate 2 years ago at Siena, and I've been here ever since. In 2 weeks, I'll be 30." "Sorry," said Selden, smiling in his turn, "but you can't expect to look 24 and not raise doubts as to your academic status." "Aren't you nice?" said Doris. And Selden felt a certain pleasure wash over him. After all, he thought, you can't exchange pleasantries with an attractive woman and feel entirely like a stranger. 18. Doris was right. Breakfast was by no means bad. There was something that was unmistakably eggy, and the meat was pleasantly smoked. The chocolate drink, Trantor was strong on chocolate, and Selden did not mind that, was probably synthetic, but it was tasty, and the breakfast rolls were good. He felt it only right to say as much. "This has been a very pleasant breakfast. Food, surroundings, everything."
"I'm delighted you think so," said Doris.
Selden looked about. There were a bank of windows in one wall, and while actual sunlight did not enter, he wondered if, after a while, he would learn to be satisfied with diffuse daylight and would cease to look for patches of sunlight in a room. The place was light enough. In fact, it was quite bright, for the local weather computer had apparently decided it was time for a sharp, clear day. The tables were arranged for four apiece, and most were occupied by the full number, but Doris and Selden remained alone at theirs. Doris had called over some of the men and women and had introduced them. All had been polite, but none had joined them. Undoubtedly, Doris intended that to be so, but Selden did not see how she managed to arrange it. He said, "You haven't introduced me to any mathematicians, Doris."
"I haven't seen any that I know. Most mathematicians start the day early and have classes by 8. My own feeling is that any student so foolhardy as to take mathematics wants to get that part of the course over with as soon as possible."
"I take it you're not a mathematician yourself."
"Anything but," said Doris with a short laugh. "Anything. History is my field. I've already published some studies on the rise of Trantor. I mean the primitive kingdom, not this world. I suppose that'll end up as my field of specialization. Royal Trantor."
"Wonderful," said Selden.
"Wonderful?" Doris looked at him quizzically. "Are you interested in Royal Trantor, too?"
"In a way, yes. That and other things like that. I've never really studied history, and I should have."
"Should you? If you had studied history, you'd scarcely have had time to study mathematics, and mathematicians are very much needed, especially at this university. We're full to here with historians," she said, raising her hand to her eyebrows, "and economists and political scientists, but we're short on science and mathematics. Cheddar Hummond pointed that out to me once. He called it the decline of science, and seemed to think it was a general phenomenon."
Selden said, "Of course, when I say I should have studied history, I don't mean that I should have made it a life work. I meant I should have studied enough to help me in my mathematics. My field of specialization is the mathematical analysis of social structure."
"Sounds horrible."
"In a way it is. It's very complicated, and without my knowing a great deal more about how societies evolved, it's hopeless. My picture is too static, you see."
"I can't see, because I know nothing about it. Cheddar told me you were developing something called psychohistory, and that it was important. Have I got it right? Psychohistory?"
"That's right.
I should have called it psychosociology, but it seemed to me that was too ugly a word. Or perhaps I knew instinctively that a knowledge of history was necessary, and then didn't pay sufficient attention to my thoughts. Psychohistory does sound better, but I don't know what it is. I scarcely do myself. He brooded a few minutes, looking at the woman on the other side of the table, and feeling that she might make this exile of his seem a little less like an exile. He thought of the other woman he had known a few years ago, but blocked it off with a determined effort. If he ever found another companion, it would have to be one who understood scholarship and what it demanded of a person. To get his mind onto a new track, he said, "Cheddar Hummond told me that the university is in no way troubled by the government." "He's right." Selden shook his head. "That seems rather unbelievably forbearing of the imperial government. The educational institutions on Helicon are by no means so independent of governmental pressures." "Nor on Cinna. Nor on any outworld, except perhaps for one or two of the largest. Trentor is another matter." "Yes, but why?" "Because it's the center of the empire. The universities here have enormous prestige. Professionals are turned out by any university anywhere, but the administrators of the empire, the high officials, the countless millions of people who represent the tentacles of empire reaching into every corner of the galaxy are educated right here on Trentor." "I've never seen the statistics," began Selden. "Take my word for it. It is important that the officials of the Empire have some common ground, some special feeling for the Empire. And they can't all be native Trantorians, or else the outworlds would grow restless. For that reason, Trantor must attract millions of outworlders for education here. It doesn't matter where they come from, or what their home accent or culture may be, as long as they pick up the Trantorian patina and identify themselves with a Trantorian educational background. That's what holds the empire together. The outworlds are also less restive when a noticeable portion of the administrators who represent the imperial government are their own people by birth and upbringing." Selden felt embarrassed again. This was something he had never given any thought to. He wondered if anyone could be a truly great mathematician, if mathematics was all he knew. He said, "Is this common knowledge?" "I suppose it isn't," said Doris after some thought. "There's so much knowledge to be had that specialists cling to their specialties as a shield against having to know anything about anything else. They avoid being drowned."
"Yet you know it."
"But that's my specialty. I'm a historian who deals with the rise of Royal Trentor, and this administrative technique was one of the ways in which Trentor spread its influence and managed the transition from Royal Trentor to Imperial Trentor." Selden said, almost as though muttering to himself, "How harmful over-specialization is. It cuts knowledge at a million points and leaves it bleeding."
Doris shrugged.
"What can one do? But you see, if Trentor is going to attract outworlders to Trantorian universities, it has to give them something in return for uprooting themselves and going to a strange world with an incredibly artificial structure and unusual ways. I've been here 2 years, and I'm still not used to it. I may never get used to it. But then, of course, I don't intend to be an administrator, so I'm not forcing myself to be a Trantorian. And what Trentor offers in exchange is not only the promise of a position with high status, considerable power, and money, of course, but also freedom. While students are having their education, they are free to denounce the government, demonstrate against it peacefully, work out their own theories and points of view. They enjoy that, and many come here so that they can experience the sensation of liberty.
I imagine, said Selden, that it helps relieve pressure as well. They work off all their resentments, enjoy all the smug self-satisfaction a young revolutionary would have, and by the time they take their place in the imperial hierarchy, they are ready to settle down into conformity and obedience.
Doris nodded. You may be right. In any case, the government, for all these reasons, carefully preserves the freedom of the universities. It's not a matter of their being forbearing at all, only clever.
And if you're not going to be an administrator, Doris, what are you going to be?
A historian. I'll teach, put book films of my own into the programming.
Not much status, perhaps.
Not much money, Harry, which is more important. As for status, that's the sort of push and pull I just as soon avoid. I've seen many people with status, but I'm still looking for a happy one. Status won't sit still under you. You have to continually fight to keep from sinking. Even emperors manage to come to bad ends most of the time. Someday, I may just go back to Cinna and be a professor.
And a Trantorian education will give you status.
Doris laughed. I suppose so. But on Cinna, who would care? It's a dull world, full of farms, and with lots of cattle, both four-legged and two-legged.
Won't you find it dull after Trantor?
Yes, that's what I'm counting on. And if it gets too dull, I can always wangle a grant to go here or there to do a little historical research. That's the advantage of my field.
A mathematician, on the other hand, said Selden with a trace of bitterness at something that had never before bothered him, is expected to sit at his computer and think. And speaking of computers...
He hesitated. Breakfast was done, and it seemed to him more than likely she had some duties of her own to attend to. But she did not seem to be in any great hurry to leave.
Yes, speaking of computers...
Would I be able to get permission to use the history library? Now it was she who hesitated.
I think that can be arranged. If you work on mathematics programming, you'll probably be viewed as a quasi-member of the faculty, and I could ask for you to be given permission, only...
Only?
I don't want to hurt your feelings, but you're a mathematician, and you say you know nothing about history. Would you know how to make use of a history library?
Selden smiled. I suppose you use computers very much like those in a mathematics library.
We do, but the programming for each specialty has quirks of its own. You don't know the standard reference book films, the quick methods of winnowing and skipping. You may be able to find a hyperbolic interval in the dark.
You mean hyperbolic integral, interrupted Selden softly.
Doris ignored him.
But you probably won't know how to get the terms of the Treaty of Poldark in less than a day and a half.
I suppose I could learn.
If...
She looked a little troubled.
If you want to, I can make a suggestion. I give a week's course, 1 hour each day, no credit, on library use. It's for undergraduates. Would you feel it beneath your dignity to sit in on such a course? With undergraduates, I mean. It starts in 3 weeks.
You could give me private lessons.
Selden felt a little surprised at the suggestive tone that had entered his voice.
She did not miss it.
I dare say I could, but I think you'd be better off with more formal instruction. We'll be using the library, you understand, and at the end of the week you will be asked to locate information on particular items of historical interest. You will be competing with the other students all through, and that will help you learn. Private tutoring will be far less efficient, I assure you. However, I understand the difficulty of competing with undergraduates. If you don't do as well as they, you may feel humiliated. You must remember, though, that they have already studied elementary history, and you perhaps may not have.
I haven't. No may about it. But I won't be afraid to compete, and I won't mind any humiliation that may come along, if I manage to learn the tricks of the historical reference trade. It was clear to Selden that he was beginning to like this young woman, and that he was gladly seizing on the chance to be educated by her. He was also aware of the fact that he had reached a turning point in his mind. He had promised Hummin to attempt to work out a practical psychohistory, but that had been a promise of the mind and not the emotions. Now he was determined to seize psychohistory by the throat, if he had to, in order to make it practical. That, perhaps, was the influence of Doris Venabile. Or had Hummin counted on that? Hummin, Selden decided, might well be a most formidable person. 19. Cleon I had finished dinner, which unfortunately had been a formal state affair. It meant he had to spend time talking to various officials, not one of whom he knew or recognized, in set phrases designed to give each one his stroke and so activate his loyalty to the crown. It also meant that his food reached him but lukewarm and had cooled still further before he could eat it. There had to be some way of avoiding that. Eat first, perhaps, on his own or with one or two close intimates with whom he could relax, and then attend a formal dinner at which he could merely be served an imported pear. He loved pears. But would that offend the guests who would take the emperor's refusal to eat with them as a studied insult? His wife, of course, was useless in this respect, for her presence would but further exacerbate his unhappiness. He had married her because she was a member of a powerful dissident family who could be expected to mute their dissidence as a result of the union, though Cleon devoutly hoped that she, at least, would not do so. He was perfectly content to have her live her own life in her own quarters, except for the necessary efforts to initiate an heir. For, to tell the truth, he didn't like her. And now that an heir had come, he could ignore her completely. He chewed at one of a handful of nuts he had pocketed from the table on leaving, and said, "Demerzel?"
"Sire?"
Demerzel always appeared at once when Cleon called. Whether he hovered constantly in earshot at the door, or he drew close because the instinct of subservience somehow alerted him to a possible call in a few minutes, he did appear, and that, Cleon thought idly, was the important thing. Of course, there were those times when Demerzel had to be away on imperial business. Cleon always hated those absences. They made him uneasy.
"What happened to that mathematician? I forget his name."
Demerzel, who surely knew the man the emperor had in mind, but who perhaps wanted to study how much the emperor remembered, said,
"What mathematician is it that you have in mind, sire?"
Cleon waved an impatient hand.
"The fortune-teller, the one who came to see me."
"The one we sent for?"
"Well, sent for, then. He did come to see me. You were going to take care of the matter, as I recall. Have you?"
Demerzel cleared his throat.
"Sire, I have tried to."
"Ah, that means you have failed, doesn't it?"
In a way, Cleon felt pleased. Demerzel was the only one of his ministers who made no bones of failure. The others never admitted failure, and since failure was nevertheless common, it became difficult to correct. Perhaps Demerzel could afford to be more honest because he failed so rarely. If it weren't for Demerzel, Cleon thought sadly,
he might never know what honesty sounded like. Perhaps no emperor ever knew, and perhaps that was one of the reasons that the empire... He pulled his thoughts away, and suddenly nettled at the other's silence and wanting an admission, since he had just admired Demerzel's honesty in his mind, said sharply,
"Well, you have failed, haven't you?"
Demerzel did not flinch. "Sire, I have failed in part. I felt that to have him here on Trentor, where things are difficult, might present us with problems. It was easy to consider that he might be more conveniently placed on his home planet. He was planning to return to that home planet the next day, but there was always the chance of complications, of his deciding to remain on Trentor. So I arranged to have two young alleymen place him on his plane that very day."
"Do you know alleymen, Demerzel?"
Cleon was amused. "It is important, sire, to be able to reach many kinds of people, for each type has its own variety of use. Alleymen, not the least. As it happens, they did not succeed."
"And why was that?"
"Oddly enough, Selden was able to fight them off."
"The mathematician could fight?"
"Apparently, mathematics and the martial arts are not necessarily mutually exclusive. I found out, not soon enough, that his world, Helicon, is noted for it. Martial arts, not mathematics. The fact that I did not learn this earlier was indeed a failure, sire, and I can only crave your pardon."
"But then, I suppose the mathematician left for his home planet the next day as he had planned."
"Unfortunately, the episode backfired. Taken aback by the event, he decided not to return to Helicon, but remained on Trentor. He may have been advised to this effect by a passerby who happened to be present on the occasion of the fight. That was another unlooked-for complication." The Emperor Cleon frowned.
"Then our mathematician, what is his name?"
"Selden, sire. Harry Selden."
"Then this Selden is out of reach?"
"In a sense, sire. We have traced his movements, and he is now at Streeling University. While there, he is untouchable." The Emperor scowled and reddened slightly.
"I am annoyed at that word, untouchable. There should be nowhere in the Empire my hand cannot reach. Yet here, on my own world, you tell me someone can be untouchable, insufferable."
"Your hand can reach to the university, sire. You can send in your army and pluck out this Selden at any moment you desire. To do so, however, is undesirable."
"Why don't you say impractical, Demerzel? You sound like the mathematician speaking of his fortune-telling. It is possible, but impractical. I am an emperor who finds everything possible, but very little practical. Remember, Demerzel, if reaching Selden is not practical, reaching you is entirely so."
Ato Demerzel let this last comment pass. The man behind the throne knew his importance to the emperor. He had heard such threats before. He waited in silence while the emperor glowered. Drumming his fingers against the arm of his chair, Cleon asked,
"Well then, what good is this mathematician to us if he is at Streeling University?"
"It may perhaps be possible, sire, to snatch use out of adversity. At the university, he may decide to work on his psychohistory."
"Even though he insists it's impractical?"
"He may be wrong, and he may find out that he is wrong. And if he finds out that he is wrong, we would find some way of getting him out of the university. It is even possible he would join us voluntarily under those circumstances."
The emperor remained lost in thought for a while, then said,
And what if someone else plucks him out before we do?
Who would want to do that, sire? Asked Demerzel softly.
The mayor of Y, for one, said Cleon, suddenly shouting. He dreams still of taking over the empire.
Old age has drawn his fangs, sire.
Don't you believe it, Demerzel?
And we have no reason for supposing he has any interest in Selden, or even knows of him, sire.
Come on, Demerzel. If we heard of the paper, so could Y. If we see the possible importance of Selden, so could Y.
If that should happen, said Demerzel, or even if there should be a reasonable chance of its happening, then we would be justified in taking strong measures.
How strong?
Demerzel said cautiously. It might be argued that rather than have Selden in Y's hands, we might prefer to have him in no one's hands. To have him cease to exist, sire.
To have him killed, you mean? Said Cleon.
If you wish to put it that way, sire, said Demerzel. 20. Harry Selden sat back in his chair in the alcove that had been assigned to him through Doris Van Abbeley's intervention. He was dissatisfied. As a matter of fact, although that was the expression he used in his mind, he knew that it was a gross underestimation of his feelings. He was not simply dissatisfied, he was furious. All the more so because he wasn't sure what it was he was furious about. Was it about the histories? The writers and compilers of histories? The worlds and people that made the histories? Whatever the target of his fury, it didn't really matter. What counted was that his notes were useless. His new knowledge was useless. Everything was useless. He had been at the university now for almost 6 weeks. He had managed to find a computer outlet at the very start, and with it had begun to work. Without instruction, but using the instincts he had developed over a number of years of mathematical labors. It had been slow and halting, but there was a certain pleasure in gradually determining the routes by which he could get his questions answered. Then came the week of instruction with Doris, which had taught him several dozen shortcuts, and had brought with it two sets of embarrassments. The first set included the sidelong glances he received from the undergraduates, who seemed contemptuously aware of his greater age, and who were disposed to frown a bit at Dora's constant use of the honorific doctor in addressing him.
I don't want them to think, she said, that you're some backward perpetual student taking remedial history.
But surely you've established the point. Surely a mere Selden is sufficient now.
No, said Doris, and smiled suddenly. Besides, I like to call you Dr. Selden. I like the way you look uncomfortable each time.
You have a peculiar sense of sadistic humor.
Would you deprive me?
For some reason that made him laugh. Surely the natural reaction would have been to deny sadism. Somehow he found it pleasant that she accepted the ball of conversation and fired it back. The thought led to a natural question. Do you play tennis here at the university?
We have courts, but I don't play.
Good. I'll teach you. And when I do, I'll call you Professor Van Abbeley.
That's what you call me in class, anyway.
You'll be surprised how ridiculous it will sound on the tennis court.
I may get to like it.
In that case, I will try to find what else you might get to like.
I see you have a peculiar sense of salacious humor.
She had put that ball in that spot deliberately, and he said,
Would you deprive me?
She smiled, and later did surprisingly well on the tennis court.
Are you sure you never played tennis? He said, puffing after one session.
Positive,
she said.
The other set of embarrassments was more private. He learned the necessary techniques of historical research, and then burned, in private, at his earlier attempts to make use of the computer's memory. It was simply an entirely different mindset from that used in mathematics. It was equally logical, he supposed, since it could be used, consistently and without error, to move in whatever direction he wanted to. But it was a substantially different brand of logic from that to which he was accustomed. But, with or without instructions, whether he stumbled or moved in swiftly, he simply didn't get any results. His annoyance made itself felt on the tennis court. Doris quickly reached the stage where it was no longer necessary to lob easy balls at her to give her time to judge direction and distance. That made it easy to forget that she was just a beginner. And he expressed his anger in his swing, firing the ball back at her as though it were a laser beam made solid. She came trotting up to the net and said,
"I can understand your wanting to kill me, since it must annoy you to watch me miss the shots so often. How is it, though, that you managed to miss my head by about 3 centimeters that time? I mean, you didn't even nick me. Can't you do better than that?"
Selden, horrified, tried to explain, but only managed to sound incoherent. She said,
"Look, I'm not going to face any other returns of yours today. So why don't we shower, and then get together for some tea, and whatever, and you can tell me just what you were trying to kill. If it wasn't my poor head, and if you don't get the real victim off your chest, you'll be entirely too dangerous on the other side of the net for me to want to serve as a target."
Over tea, he said, "Doris, I've scanned history after history, just scanned, browsed. I haven't had time for deep study yet. Even so, it's become obvious. All the book films concentrate on the same few events.
Crucial ones, history-making ones."
"That's just an excuse. They're copying each other. There are 25 million worlds out there, and there's significant mention of perhaps 25.
Doris said, "You're reading general galactic histories only. Look up the special histories of some of the minor worlds. On every world, however small, the children are taught local histories before they ever find out there's a great big galaxy outside. Don't you yourself know more about Helicon right now than you know about the rise of Trantor? Or of the great interstellar war?"
"That sort of knowledge is limited, too," said Selden gloomily. "I know Heliconian geography and the stories of its settlement, and of the malfeasance and misfeasance of the planet Genesec. That's our traditional enemy, though our teachers carefully told us that we ought to say traditional rival. But I never learned anything about the contributions of Helicon to general galactic history."
"Maybe there weren't any."
"Don't be silly. Of course there were. There may not have been great, huge space battles involving Helicon, or crucial rebellions or peace treaties. There may not have been some imperial competitor making his base on Helicon. But there must have been subtle influences. Surely, nothing can happen anywhere without affecting everywhere else. Yet, there's nothing I can find to help me.
See here, Doris. In mathematics, all can be found in the computer, everything we know or have found out in 20,000 years. In history, that's not so. Historians pick and choose, and every one of them picks and chooses the same thing."
"But Harry," said Doris,
Mathematics is an orderly thing of human invention. One thing follows from another. There are definitions and axioms, all of which are known. It is all one piece. History is different. It is the unconscious working out of the deeds and thoughts of quadrillions of human beings. Historians must pick and choose.
Exactly, said Selden. But I must know all of history if I am to work out the laws of psychohistory.
In that case, you won't ever formulate the laws of psychohistory.
That was yesterday. Now Selden sat in his chair in his alcove, having spent another day of utter failure. And he could hear Dor's voice saying, In that case, you won't ever formulate the laws of psychohistory. It was what he had thought to begin with. And if it hadn't been for Hummin's conviction to the contrary, and his odd ability to fire Selden with his own blaze of conviction, Selden would have continued to think so. And yet, neither could he quite let go. Might there not be some way out? He couldn't think of any.
Upperside. Trentor. It is almost never pictured as a world seen from space. It has long since captured the general mind of humanity as a world of the interior, and the image is that of the human hive that existed under the domes. Yet there was an exterior as well, and there are holographs that still remain that were taken from space and show varying degrees of detail, say figures 14 and 15. Note that the surface of the domes, the interface of the vast city and the overlying atmosphere, a surface referred to in its time as upperside, is Encyclopedia Galactica.
21. Yet the following day found Harry Selden back in the library. For one thing, there was his promise to Hummin. He had promised to try, and he couldn't very well make it a half-hearted process. For another, he owed something to himself, too. He resented having to admit failure. Not yet, at least. Not while he could plausibly tell himself he was following up leads. So he stared at the list of reference book films he had not yet checked through, and tried to decide which of the unappetizing number had the slightest chance of being useful to him. He had about decided that the answer was none of the above. And saw no way out but to look at samples of each, when he was startled by a gentle tap against the alcove wall. Selden looked up, and found the embarrassed face of Lisung Randa peering at him around the edge of the alcove opening. Selden knew Randa, had been introduced to him by Dors, and had dined with him, and with others, on several occasions. Randa, an instructor in psychology, was a little man, short and plump, with a round, cheerful face and an almost perpetual smile. He had a sallow complexion and the narrowed eyes so characteristic of people on millions of worlds. Selden knew that appearance well, for there were many of the great mathematicians who had borne it, and he had frequently seen their holograms. Yet on Helicon he had never seen one of these Easterners. By tradition they were called that, though no one knew why, and the Easterners themselves were said to resent the term to some degree, but again, no one knew why. "There's millions of us here on Trantor," Randa had said, smiling with no trace of self-consciousness, when Selden, on first meeting him, had not been able to repress all trace of startled surprise. "You'll also find a lot of Southerners, dark skins, tightly curled hair. Did you ever see one?" "Not on Helicon," muttered Selden. "All Westerners on Helicon, eh? How dull. But it doesn't matter. Takes all kinds."
He left Selden wondering at the fact that there were Easterners, Southerners, and Westerners, but no Northerners. He had tried finding an answer to why that might be in his reference searches, and had not succeeded. And now, Rhonda's good-natured face was looking at him with an almost ludicrous look of concern. He said, "Are you all right, Selden?" Selden stared. "Yes, of course. Why shouldn't I be?" "I'm just going by sounds, my friend. You were screaming." "Screaming?" Selden looked at him with offended disbelief. "Not loud, like this." Rhonda gritted his teeth and emitted a strangled, high-pitched sound from the back of his throat. "If I'm wrong, I apologize for this unwarranted intrusion on you. Please forgive me." Selden hung his head. "You're forgiven, Lee Sung. I do make that sound sometimes, I'm told. I assure you it's unconscious. I'm never aware of it." "Are you aware why you make it?" "Yes." "Frustration." "Frustration." Rhonda beckoned Selden closer and lowered his voice further. "We're disturbing people. Let's come out to the lounge before we're thrown out." In the lounge, over a pair of mild drinks, Rhonda said, "May I ask you, as a matter of professional interest, why you are feeling frustration?" Selden shrugged.
"Why does one usually feel frustration?"
"I'm tackling something in which I am making no progress." "But you're a mathematician, Harry. Why should anything in the history library frustrate you?"
"What were you doing here?"
"Passing through as part of a shortcut to where I was going when I heard you moaning."
"Now you see," and he smiled. "It's no longer a shortcut, but a serious delay. One that I welcome, however." "I wish I were just passing through the history library. But I'm trying to solve a mathematical problem that requires some knowledge of history, and I'm afraid I'm not handling it well." Rhonda stared at Selden with an unusually solemn expression on his face. Then he said, "Pardon me, but I must run the risk of offending you now. I've been computering you."
"Computering me?"
Selden's eyes widened. He felt distinctly angry. "I have offended you. But you know, I had an uncle who was a mathematician. You might even have heard of him. Kyung Tao, Rhonda."
Selden drew in his breath. "Are you a relative of that, Rhonda?"
"Yes. He is my father's older brother, and he was quite displeased with me for not following in his footsteps. He has no children of his own. I thought somehow that it might please him that I had met a mathematician, and I wanted to boast of you if I could. So I checked what information the mathematics library might have."
"I see. And that's what you were really doing there. Well, I'm sorry. I don't suppose you could do much boasting."
"You suppose wrong. I was impressed. I couldn't make heads or tails of the subject matter of your papers, but somehow the information seemed to be very favorable. And when I checked the news files, I found you were at the decennial convention earlier this year. So, what's psychohistory anyway? Obviously, the first two syllables stir my curiosity."
"I see you got that word out of it."
"Unless I'm totally misled, it seemed to me that you can work out the future course of history."
Selden nodded wearily. "That, more or less, is what psychohistory is, or rather, what it is intended to be."
"But is it a serious study?"
Rhonda was smiling. "You don't just throw sticks."
"Throw sticks? That's just a reference to a game played by children on my home planet of Hopara. The game is supposed to tell the future, and if you're a smart kid, you can make a good thing out of it. Tell a mother that her child will grow up beautiful and marry a rich man, and it's good for a piece of cake or a half-credit piece on the spot. She isn't going to wait and see if it comes true. You are rewarded just for saying it.
I see. No, I don't throw sticks. Psychohistory is just an abstract study. Strictly abstract. It has no practical application at all, except... Now we're getting to it. Exceptions are what are interesting. Except that I would like to work out such an application. Perhaps if I knew more about history.
Ah, that is why you are reading history.
Yes, but it does me no good, said Selden sadly. There is too much history, and there is too little of it that is told.
And that's what's frustrating you?
Selden nodded.
Rhonda said, But Harry, you've only been here a matter of weeks.
True, but already I can see...
You can't see anything in a few weeks. You may have to spend your whole lifetime making one little advance. It may take many generations of work by many mathematicians to make a real inroad on the problem.
I know that, Lisung, but that doesn't make me feel better. I want to make some visible progress myself.
Well, driving yourself to distraction won't help either. If it will make you feel better, I can give you an example of a subject much less complex than human history that people have been working for I don't know how long without making much progress. I know because a group is working on it right here at the university, and one of my good friends is involved. Talk about frustration. You don't know what frustration is.
What's the subject?
Selden felt a small curiosity stirring within him. Meteorology.
Meteorology?
Selden felt revolted at the anticlimax. Don't make faces. Look, every inhabited world has an atmosphere. Every world has its own atmospheric composition, its own temperature range, its own rotation and revolution rate, its own axial tipping, its own land-water distribution. We've got 25 million different problems, and no one has succeeded in finding a generalization.
That's because atmospheric behavior easily enters a chaotic phase. Everyone knows that.
So my friend Jenar Lagan says. You've met him.
Selden considered. Tall fellow, long nose, doesn't speak much.
That's the one.
And Trantor itself is a bigger puzzle than almost any world. According to the records, it had a fairly normal weather pattern when it was first settled. Then, as the population grew and urbanization spread, more energy was used and more heat was discharged into the atmosphere. The ice cover contracted, the cloud layer thickened, and the weather got lousier. That encouraged the movement underground and set off a vicious cycle. The worse the weather got, the more eagerly the land was dug into and the domes built, and the weather got still worse. Now the planet has become a world of almost incessant cloudiness and frequent rains, or snows when it's cold enough. The only thing is that no one can work it out properly. No one has worked out an analysis that can explain why the weather has deteriorated quite as it has, or how one can reasonably predict the details of its day-to-day changes.
Selden shrugged. Is that sort of thing important? To a meteorologist, it is. Why can't they be as frustrated over their problems as you are over yours? Don't be a project chauvinist. Selden remembered the cloudiness and the dank chill on the way to the Emperor's palace. He said, "So what's being done about it?" "Well, there's a big project on the matter here at the university, and Jannar Legan is part of it. They feel that if they can understand the weather change on Trantor, they will learn a great deal about the basic laws of general meteorology. Legan wants that as much as you want your laws of psychohistory. So he has set up an incredible array of instruments of all kinds upperside. You know, above the domes. It hasn't helped them so far. And if there's so much work being done for many generations on the atmosphere without results, how can you complain that you haven't gotten anything out of human history in a few weeks?" Rhonda was right, Selden thought, and he himself was being unreasonable and wrong. And yet, Hammond would say that this failure in the scientific attack on problems was another sign of the degeneration of the times. Perhaps he was right also, except that he was speaking of a general degeneration and average effect. Selden felt no degeneration of ability and mentality in himself. He said with some interest then, "You mean that people climb up out of the domes and into the open air above?" "Yes, upper side. It's a funny thing, though. Most native Trantorians won't do it. They don't like to go upper side. The idea gives them vertigo or something. Most of those working on the meteorology project are outworlders." Selden looked out of the window at the lawns and small garden of the university campus, brilliantly lit without shadows or oppressive heat, and said thoughtfully, "I don't know that I can blame Trantorians for liking the comfort of being within, but I should think curiosity would drive some upper side. It would drive me." "Do you mean that you would like to see meteorology in action?" "I think I would. How does one get upper side?" "Nothing to it. An elevator takes you up, a door opens, and there you are. I've been up there. It's novel." "It would get my mind off psychohistory for a while," Selden sighed. "I'd welcome that." "On the other hand," said Rhonda, "my uncle used to say, all knowledge is one, and he may be right. You may learn something from meteorology that will help you with your psychohistory. Isn't that possible?" Selden smiled weakly. "A great many things are possible." And to himself he added, "but not practical." 22. Doris seemed amused. "Meteorology?" Selden said, "Yes. There's work scheduled for tomorrow, and I'll go up with them." "Are you tired of history?" Selden nodded his head somberly. "Yes, I am. I'll welcome the change. Besides, Rhonda says it's another problem that's too massive for mathematics to handle, and it will do me good to see that my situation isn't unique." "I hope you're not agoraphobic." Selden smiled. "No, I'm not, but I see why you ask. Rhonda says that Trantorians are frequently agoraphobic and won't go upper side. I imagine they feel uncomfortable without a protective enclosure." Doris nodded. "You can see where that would be natural. But there are also many Trantorians who are to be found among the planets of the galaxy. Tourists, administrators, soldiers. And agoraphobia isn't particularly rare in the outworlds either." "That may be, Doris, but I'm not agoraphobic. I am curious, and I welcome the change, so I'll be joining them tomorrow." Doris hesitated. "I should go up with you, but I have a heavy schedule tomorrow. Still, if you're not agoraphobic, you'll have no trouble, and you'll probably enjoy yourself. Oh, and stay close to the meteorologists. I've heard of people getting lost up there.
I'll be careful. It's a long time since I've gotten truly lost anywhere.
23.
Jannar Lagan had a dark look about him. It was not so much his complexion, which was fair enough. It was not even his eyebrows, which were thick and dark enough. It was rather that those eyebrows were hunched over deep-set eyes, and a long and rather prominent nose. He had, as a result, a most unmerry look. His eyes did not smile, and when he spoke, which wasn't often, he had a deep, strong voice, surprisingly resonant for his rather thin body. He said, "You'll need warmer clothing than that, Selden." Selden said, "Oh?" and looked about. There were two men and two women who were making ready to go up with Lagan and Selden, and, as in Lagan's own case, their rather satiny Trantorian clothing was covered by thick sweaters that, not surprisingly, were brightly colored in bold designs. No two were even faintly alike, of course. Selden looked down at himself and said, "Sorry, I didn't know, but I don't have any suitable outer garment."
"I can give you one. I think there's a spare here somewhere."
"Yes, here it is. A little threadbare, but it's better than nothing." "Wearing sweaters like these can make you unpleasantly warm," said Selden.
"Here they would," said Lagan. "Other conditions exist upperside. Cold and windy. Too bad I don't have spare leggings and boots for you, too. You'll want them later."
They were taking with them a cart of instruments, which they were testing one by one, with what Selden thought was unnecessary slowness.
"Your home planet cold?" asked Lagan.
Selden said, "Parts of it, of course. The part of Helicon I come from is mild and often rainy."
"Too bad. You won't like the weather upperside."
"I think I can manage to endure it for the time we'll be up there." When they were ready, the group filed into an elevator that was marked "Official Use Only." "That's because it goes upperside," said one of the young women, "and people aren't supposed to be up there without good reason." Selden had not met the young woman before, but he had heard her addressed as Clausia. He didn't know if that was a first name, a last name, or a nickname. The elevator seemed no different from others that Selden had been on, either here on Trantor or at home in Helicon, barring, of course, the gravitic lift he and Hummin had used. But there was something about knowing that it was going to take him out of the confines of the planet and into emptiness above that made it feel like a spaceship. Selden smiled internally, a foolish fantasy. The elevator quivered slightly, which reminded Selden of Hummin's forebodings of galactic decay. Lagan, along with the other men and one of the women, seemed frozen and waiting, as though they had suspended thought as well as activity until they could get out. But Clausia kept glancing at him, as though she found him terribly impressive. Selden leaned close and whispered to her. He hesitated to disturb the others.
"Are we going up very high?"
"High?" she repeated. She spoke in a normal voice, apparently not feeling that the others required silence. She seemed very young, and it occurred to Selden that she was probably an undergraduate, an apprentice perhaps. "We're taking a long time. Upperside must be many stories high in the air." For a moment she looked puzzled, then,
"Oh no, not high at all. We started very deep. The university is at a low level. We use a great deal of energy, and if we're quite deep, the energy costs are lower.
Legan said, All right, we're here. Let's get the equipment out.
The elevator stopped with a